More than 1.2 million people in the United States are living with HIV. And although it's no longer a death sentence due to new antiretroviral medications, Charlie Sheen's revelations illustrate how HIV is still veiled in shame and secrecy. Lingering stigma can keep people with HIV from getting the care they need. The stigma and shame have been found to negatively impact people living with the disease. It can keep patients from seeking out medical care in the first place and affect their willingness to stick with complicated regimens of medications which are critical to keeping them healthy and reducing HIV transmission over the long term. Patients who feel stigmatized can wind up isolated and without the will to manage their disease. It's our pleasure today to have on the program Allison Webble, RN, PhD. She's a pioneer in research on HIV self-management and lead author of the new book, Living a Healthy Life with HIV, which is in its fourth edition. She's also a prominent researcher who focuses on the field of HIV self-management. Allison, it's nice to have you on the program today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Okay, we've got a program today talking about something that other people don't want to talk about primarily, and that's HIV. Define for us, well, no, before you do that, tell us a little bit about your background.
So I am, by background, a nurse. I've worked in clinical oncology, and then when I moved out west to do my graduate work, I was a public health nurse in an HIV team in San Francisco, and I spent a few years doing that. And currently my work has been focusing on how to improve self-management in adults living with HIV, and we focus mostly on health-promoting things, so things like diet and exercise and sleep that we know are important for everybody, including people living with HIV.
Okay. Now, people have heard the term AIDS, and they've heard the term HIV. Contrast those two terms for me, please.
So HIV it stands for the human immunodeficiency virus. It is a virus that can lead to one's immune system not functioning at all, or certainly as well as it should be. And when the virus takes over enough of one's immune system, individuals can develop what's called AIDS. AIDS is a syndrome. It's acquired immune deficiency syndrome. It's a development of diseases that you wouldn't normally see in people who have healthy immune systems. So some of the more visual ones are things like Kaposi's sarcoma. If your listeners have seen Philadelphia, I think there are some very graphic examples of things like Kaposi's sarcoma, different types of pneumonias, different types of cancers, and stomach disorders that, you know, if you have a healthy functioning immune system, you would not be developing these things. So HIV is the virus, and AIDS is when the virus overtakes your body to a point where you can't fight off normal infections or diseases.
Why can't our body with the built-in things that we have in our immune system, why can't it get rid of the virus?
Oh, our immune system is amazing. it can fight off so much. But this virus is also a very smart virus. It knows how to evolve to and to hide. So it can evolve to be resistant to the medications that we know can help it. And it also can hide. It can hide in places that our medications can't normally reach. We know that this virus can go into the brain. We know this virus can go deep into someone's intestines, which make it hard to fully eradicate, or really what you're asking is, why can't we cure it? To cure our body from HIV. So we're trying really hard to harness a lot of our own immune system to help develop a cure for HIV, but we're not quite there yet. And I think that, I'm hoping in the next 30 to 40 years, we actually will be able to harness our own immune system to really fight off and to cure HIV.
What's it like for a person who is living with HIV today in this country?
So, you know, anyone can have HIV today, and a person who is on medication, who is involved in regular care, medical care, and is working and has a good support system, they have a life like any other person with a chronic disease, like diabetes or heart disease or hypertension. But there are still a lot of communities and a lot of places where a person living with HIV does, and you mentioned in your introduction, does still live with stigma and shame. And we see this a lot in more newly diagnosed people who are newly diagnosed with HIV, and people who are younger. They think that HIV is something to be ashamed of, that it's their fault, and so they may be less inclined to go to the doctor, to get on their medications. And those are people who can get sick. We have phenomenal medications that can entirely control the virus and help someone who has HIV live an approximately normal lifespan. So they can, in the United States today, someone with HIV can live to be in their 70s.
Okay.
But if they don't have their medications or they're not engaged in care for perhaps because of stigma, but also because of they don't have access to care, they don't have access to providers who understand HIV and treat them with the respect they deserve, they can get very sick. Once someone has HIV, everybody's response will be somewhat different. But in general, if they don't have HIV, if they don't have medications, they will start to see their immune system, disintegrate. So initially what you'll see with someone who has HIV is after about two to 4 weeks of infection, they'll start to have flu-like symptoms, swollen lymph nodes, achy joints, fevers, perhaps some headache. They'll be tired, and then their immune system starts to fight, and it's it will consistently fight until it runs out, and hopefully before it runs out, the individual has started on medications. And what those medications do is they can help stop that virus from replicating in someone's body. And it can help their immune system start to bounce back, to rebuild itself. So those medications really are critical for someone to have a healthy and long life.
How does a person who has recently been diagnosed as HIV positive break that news to their family, friends, and lovers?
Oh, this is one of the hardest questions we get asked, I think the first point to get across is that, it always needs to be that person's choice. Only that individual knows the circumstances in which they live, if they can disclose safely to someone, and they know the support resources that they have. So once someone has decided to tell someone that they have HIV, they can start a conversation about it. We've had patients bring their either their partners or their spouse to the office to help them describe what HIV is to them. And some people just are more comfortable with explaining what it is to their family. There's no right or wrong way to disclose your HIV status to someone in your life, but the important thing is knowing that there are a lot of tools and resources to help people do this, because we do know that disclosing HIV status to people in your life does help build social support that is so critical to managing this disease well. And it also helps to reduce HIV infection. If you're telling your husband or your wife or your partner that you have HIV, they are more likely to engage in behaviors and that will reduce the risk of transmitting HIV. So disclosure is a really important piece, but there is no right or wrong way of doing it. So there are lots of resources from the federal government on the internet that can help people learn how to disclose in a safe, understandable way. There are support groups. Almost all HIV clinics have case managers who can help individuals kind of role play the scenario and talk about things that they're scared about when they disclose, and practice that response. Because we know it's something that's very traumatic, but also something that's so critical to the health of the individual living with HIV and also to their community.
Well, we know that HIV is communicable. So what What do you want to get across in terms of major points to people listening today who get the news that their family member or their lover now has HIV with respect to them getting it themselves?
So HIV is not transmitted by regular contact. I think that's probably the first point we want people to know. You know, you can't catch HIV by being in the same room with someone or having someone with HIV cough. It's only transmitted through body fluids. So through sexual contact, through vaginal fluid and semen. So sexual contact is probably it's the most common way HIV is transmitted today. Through blood. So the most common way here we see it is through sharing of needles. An important part here is, I think it's important to remind people that, you know, all blood in blood banks has been screened. So, you know, and this has been going on for 20 years. So we now have a really good system in place to prevent blood transfusions from transmitting HIV or hepatitis or other conditions. And then, and this is increasingly less a problem, but things like breast milk. So we do not encourage mothers who have HIV to breastfeed unless they're in a setting in which formula is not available. So, you know, so those are the only ways HIV can be transmitted. And the one that we're working the most hard on, prevention, is with sexual contact, because we know that's the primary way in which people are being infected. So there's a lot of, in the last 3 to 4 years, we've learned a lot about how to prevent sexual transmission. The first one is talking to people that you're having sex with, asking them about any sort of infectious disease history or HIV history or who their previous partners were, and then being tested yourself. Being tested is really important, and your partner being tested is very important. And then there are, you know, there's barrier methods, which I think when we think about safe sex, we often think about using a condom or a dental dam to prevent transmission of body fluids and the infections that are in body fluids. And then there are HIV-specific strategies that we have learned so much about that have really revolutionized how we think about HIV prevention. So the first thing is if your spouse or your partner has HIV, if they are taking the medications and they cannot find the virus in their blood, so that's something that we call undetectable viral load. If they cannot find the virus in their blood, they are about 90% less likely to transmit HIV through sexual intercourse. That's amazing, and we never knew that before, and it's leading to a whole host of both individual and community-level prevention strategies that are, we think, will actually, you know, make a big dent in helping to end the HIV epidemic. The second one is something that was approved by the FDA about 2 years ago, and it is called pre-exposure prophylaxis. So if someone is in a group or in a relationship that is high risk, so if you know your spouse or your partner has HIV and you do not have HIV, that person can actually go on medications that will also help prevent HIV transmission by about 96%. So it's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP for short. Many urban settings now have PrEP clinics. You know, there was a lot of news around Fulton County just opening one. San Francisco has one. We have one here in Cleveland. So lots of cities have these PrEP clinics for if you're in a group that is affected by HIV, you can go and get on this medication and you can reduce your likelihood of becoming infected with HIV.
But bottom line is, regardless of what you do, there's some risk that you can't get rid of. And from what I hear you saying, it's somewhat less than 5%?
somewhat less than 5%. So the medications?
Yeah, if you take medication or if your partner is on medication, the risk of transmission is going to be somewhat close to or around 5%.
Yeah, so if you're and those strategies are never done by themselves, so we would never prescribe, you know, PrEP for somebody without also encouraging them to use barrier methods, certainly to have conversations with their partner. So that combination of strategies can help reduce the risk of transmission to around 5 to 10%, yes.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that I've ever been terribly impressed with barrier methods. More people use condoms than not, but dams for oral sex doesn't seem to be all that great. You're going to get some body fluids transmitted regardless of that, are you not?
So they are certainly not fail-proof. And you know, we've been trying to get people to use condoms and dental dams for, you know, over 30 years since we've known about this disease. And the truth is there are just people who are not comfortable taking them. So the other two strategies do really help reduce the risk of HIV, which is, again, we've just learned about them in the last, you know, 2 to 4 years. Or we've learned about the effectiveness of them in the last 2 to 4 years. So we are putting, as a community and as a country, we are putting a lot of resources into trying to increase those two methods. And one thing I didn't mention, you know, kind of what underpins the success of all of these methods is someone actually knowing they have HIV. We know that, you know, almost 50% of the infections that are occurring in the United States today are being transmitted by people who don't know they have HIV. And that's a really important step. So we have been a lot of effort in trying to help everyone get tested and trying to routinize testing and set it in communities that we know are at higher risk, so urban settings, settings where there are a lot of gay or bisexual men, and settings where there's more commercial sex workers.
Okay, let's talk about testing. People want to believe that their potential new partner is not carrying this virus. So if the person gets tested for HIV, there's a length of time between the time that you acquire it and the time that you turn positive. And I believe that that's between 3 and 6 months. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But that would mean to me that a test would not be valid if you have had sexual intercourse with someone in less than a 6 month period. Is that right?
So there are two types of tests. There are instant tests you can do that, you know, if you basically put like a Q-tip in someone's mouth and test the saliva for the response to the virus. Those are about 2 to 3 months. You're right. And then there is a much more sensitive test that we can do, and we can actually detect the virus in about 2 weeks. But that requires someone to go in, get the blood test. And identify someone who could be at risk, and that's not the common scenario of people who are being tested. People using that method of testing usually are people who are much more symptomatic and in later stages of their disease process. So you're right. There is a window there. I would say 2 to 3 months that the instant test won't be able to detect everything. And I should also point out that instant test, you can actually buy that over the counter now at most drugstores and actually do that at home if you wanted to. So there are ways that are private that individuals can test themselves in their home setting. But there is that period there that, you know, which in my opinion is part of the reason talking to your partner about sex, you know, what your expectations are, who your previous partners were, what are your concerns about, you know, sexually transmitted diseases, not just HIV but all of them. That's, to me, that's much more critical to understanding both your risk for developing or contracting a new infection, but also to really engaging in a meaningful sexual relationship with someone.
Well, you're talking about previous sexual partners. What is the increased risk in terms of percentages or something along those lines of having sex with a prostitute as opposed to having sex with someone who does not sell themselves?
Yeah, I'm not aware of actually statistics around that, but what we do know is that someone who has sex with lots of partners, like a commercial sex worker, is at much greater risk simply because they're having more potential people to transmit the virus to them. Commercial sex workers, you know, if someone is having sex with a commercial sex worker, again, I think a lot of those prevention methods we talked about earlier would be really important to try to implement both on the sex worker side, but also from the person who is soliciting the sex worker.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about pregnancy and transmission. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, we've made amazing strides. And this was one of the areas where we first had a lot of success. So we know now how to almost entirely prevent mother-to-child transmission. So that's when a mother is infected with HIV and she gives birth to a baby, and the baby could either be infected or not. And part of the reason for this is all, again, the medications. It all tends to come back to those medications. So we can, you know, if a mother goes on medications while she's pregnant, and again, you can't, if she takes enough of them that she can't, you can't find that HIV virus in her blood, and then she has typically a cesarean birth with intravenous medication, the same HIV medications, and then that child immediately goes on antiretrovirals, usually we kind of like a prophylactically or just in case. You know, there are lots of babies born every year to pregnant mothers who are HIV negative. So we know that we can do a lot to prevent mother-to-child transmission, and I think what we're starting to see the results of that as more women living with HIV are committing to long-term relationships and are actually becoming pregnant and having kids. And there are organizations focused on helping them to do that, not just in the U.S., which is where I think we first started to see a lot of this, but in around the globe and in developed countries and also in developing countries now we're starting to see this.
Your book, Living a Healthy Life with HIV, is a large book, 300-something pages, as I remember, and it's been revised and updated from time to time. It's in its fourth edition. A very good book, comprehensive, I think. Who is the market for your book?
So the book is really like a self-help guide for people living with HIV. It's written with that person in mind. And I think part of the revision that we did was really to reflect, you know, the diverse population of people around the world who have HIV. The section on women is entirely new. The section on transgender people living with HIV is entirely new. So we really tried to reflect current demographic of people living with HIV in the U.S. and around the globe. That being said, we also think it's important for healthcare providers who are either primarily caring for people with HIV or people who kind of intermittently care for people living with HIV. You know, having a copy or a reference copy of the book would be helpful because there are some unique aspects of HIV medications, HIV stigma, trauma-informed care, things that would be helpful for them to have a quick reference for, so when they can, when they counsel their patients and when they talk to them, that they would be able to do it in a kind of a knowing and compassionate way.
How did they get a copy of your book?
How do people get a copy of my book?
Yeah.
Oh, well, Amazon has it. The book is called Living a Healthy Life with HIV, and it can be bought on Amazon.com. And our publisher is Bull Publishing out of Boulder, Colorado, and people can buy directly from the publishing website, so that's B-U-L-L, Publishing. And for individuals like organizations or community service providers, there is actually bulk discounts, and those are available through the publisher and not usually through Amazon.
Okay. I think the work that I do in addiction in some measure kind of overlaps with what you're doing, because in sex addiction and relationship addictions, you have a higher incidence of HIV.
Yeah.
So if anybody is addicted to anything, it wouldn't make any difference whether it was that or sugar. Go to my website, freedomfromaddiction.info, if you want more information on how sex or relationship addictions interact with having a positive HIV, to get more information. We've been talking today with Allison Webble. Dr. Webble is also a registered nurse, and she has researched and knows, you know, lots and lots and lots about HIV, as you could tell by listening to her talk today. This is a good book. You ought to go out and get a copy if you have interest in HIV and AIDS. Allison, we're down to 1 minute, and I would like to ask you the question that I try to ask everybody that's on this program. Since it's called Share Your Mission, and having a mission or purpose in life is one of the more important things that a person can do to guarantee a happier, more successful life. What's your mission?
See, my professional mission has always been to help people living with HIV live the healthiest, highest quality of life that they can. I think that is the crux of HIV self-management, and something that I derive great pleasure from when I work with clients or in research studies. People come back and tell me about how some of the work we've done has helped them to get jobs, to reconnect with families, just take better care of themselves, and see themselves as something other than sick. And I would say that's my mission.
Well, Allison, that's a great mission to have, and I applaud you for that, and I hope that you're able to do it for a long, long time. So thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.